It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
When we think of chefs, it's the glamour we notice, but there is more than meets the eye. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Gretchen Hansen recalls catching the passion for cooking at an early age, but a new book, When It's Done, Making of a Chef, she writes, that's not something that she had thought of as a profession. Eventually, she opened the restaurant Hobo's in Rehoboth Beach. In her autobiography, she describes not only the craziness of the food industry, but her own journey, from concerns about physical appearance to becoming a vegan. And we have her in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don.
So what was this fashion, this passion with food? Why did it happen at such an early age?
You know, I wonder that myself. I think about that a lot, why my calling became so early in my life. And I feel that it was mostly because food was safe, because I could make food do what I wanted it to do. Like, it behaved in a certain way. It wasn't erratic. It wasn't dramatic. It was comforting. It was love. It was there. It was physically present, and it could become an art form later in my life. But at that time, it really represented love. It represented comfort and nurturing.
Well, you describe your early childhood. I think as a quote says, I was strange and awkward and quixotic. What did you mean by that? And how does that fit into the food passion here?
I don't think I've changed that much, quite honestly. I was a very strange child. I started reading very early. I wasn't surrounded by other children, so I was surrounded by adults. And this was in the late 60s, and it was a strange time to be a child in Southern California in the late 60s. I grew up in a commune part of the time. I was surrounded by university professors and students. And I developed all these bizarre passions. Like, I was madly in love with Walter Cronkite. I mean, just madly in love with him. I thought he was just the most perfect person in the world. But that was when I was three, and that's a strange passion for a child to have. I was the same way about food. Like, I would go from recipe book to recipe book to recipe book, reading the recipes as if they were literature.
So you describe your mother, and what I could only talk about as being sort of body shaming, that is, that you were supposed to be overweight. Tell me about that experience.
That was later. That was when I became a teenager. And most teenagers, as you know, we know, they sprout hips and breasts and they become curvy, especially, you know, the girls. Boys now do too. But at that time, it was something that I think she didn't expect. And she had been shamed her whole life. So the way she parented me mimicked the way that she had been raised. And that was as a shaming structure. And so what I learned when I was in my early teens was that it was not okay to be feminine or curvy or heavy or in any way different than what the Southern California norm in the 60s was, which was, you know, basically you wore a string bikini and you were a size 00. And I was not that child. I was weird and I was heavy and I was, I didn't fit in.
I mean, a lot of women go through this even to this day.
Sure.
I mean, I can remember some television series in which some woman passes herself off as a man in order to get a job. And one of the things she notices the most is that men, they don't really pay much attention to how they look.
Sure. Well, and they don't, I don't think. I mean, it's funny because I was thinking about this the other day about how women are so conscious about the way they dress and the way their hair looks and the way their makeup is. And I watch men get dressed or men, you know, go out and present themselves in the world, and they don't really care if they wear the same shirt 2 days in a row or the same shirt twice in a week. It's not important to them. Where women, they're consciously looking at, okay, well, I wore this dress or I wore this suit and I can't wear that again for at least another month because people will see that I wore the same thing twice. And amazingly enough, no one actually notices what you wear. That's the most stunning thing that I've learned from this, is nobody cares if I wear the same jeans 5 days in a row.
So you basically, by the way, you grew up in part in a commune. What was that about?
So it was the 60s, and right, that was what was sort of happening back then. And I grew up in a commune it was a couple of years. It was very different. There were geodesic domes. It was on the property that my grandparents had bought for my mother, and it was a farm, a horse farm. And basically, the commune was filled with gay men who just were checking out for a while and expressing themselves sexually and becoming androgynous. And it was a lovely experience. When I look back at my childhood, those are my fondest memories.
Do you cook for them?
No, you know, I don't think so. I don't have any memories of cooking for them.
Huh?
The only memories I really have are around campfires and exploring the woods and the arroyos and sorrentos around our house. We lived in the middle of nowhere, and we used to go foresting, you know, basically harvesting from the plants that grew native. So I remember that, but I don't really remember the cooking.
Now, you also talk about, it's your paternal grandmother. What was that relationship like? How important was she to you?
She was incredibly important to me. She was probably the most important person in my world up until the point that I had my children. She basically raised me. I mean, my mother was there, but she wasn't really checked in all the time. So I would go back and forth and spend time with my grandmother. She taught me more how to cook and more how to basically do the things that I didn't know, like preserving and baking and things that, you know, were harder to learn from a book than not. But she was safe and she was secure. And she was how I found the Delmarva Peninsula. We used to summer with her from the time we were 2 years old. From the time I was 2 years old, I would summer with her. And every summer we would come out from Memorial Day to Labor Day and just spend the summer in Rehoboth Beach. And those are really the happiest memories of my life.
Now, you talk about how you then ultimately moved to or wound up in New York, I guess in the 1980s. And that sounds like it's that the moment that you really could have expand your culinary horizons in terms of all kinds of, not just, well, I guess, American foods, but this whole plethora of international and national foods.
Well, the 80s in New York, everything was exploding. I mean, the food supply was exploding. From one minute you have maybe cremini mushrooms, if you're lucky, the next minute there's chanterelles and shiitakes and portobellos. And all the things we take for granted now were just starting then in a way that was so exciting. You could find strawberries that were the size of your pinky. You could find fiddleheads. There were beautiful foods, Dean and DeLuca, all the places that now we think of as just standard fare. Back then, that's when they were opening, and it was like literally being in Disneyland if you were interested in food. There were so many things to explore and play with and techniques that were being, you know, learned and passed around. I mean, it was a very exciting time.
And I get the sense that this was really a major introduction to the food industry. What was that like?
It was, yeah. I look back at that time, and I'm still overwhelmed with how much knowledge was passed in that decade. You know, how I grew up basically as a chef during that period of time. I mean, one minute I'm doing pretty traditional Mexican foods and borderland foods. And the next minute, I mean, I'm being introduced to things from all over the world, Far East, sushi, you name it. I mean, it was just exploding. And it was such an exciting time. I used to go to this warehouse down in the meatpacking district, and there was this guy that had these catalogs that were just filled with all these different things that he could order in. And of course, they were so dear, you could hardly afford them. But every penny that I earned went to buying new and different foods for me to play with, different spices, saffrons and za'atars and curries. And oh my gosh, so many different things that you just didn't know, you didn't have a chance to explore up until that point.
It sounds as if that was really sort of a crazy time. But I mean, in terms of the food industry and the characteristic, the atmosphere in which you were working.
Yeah, so the 80s was, I think, marked by massive amounts of drugs. And, I mean, there's no other way to put it, and sexual promiscuity. And I certainly, more so than most, fell into that pit in the 80s. And it was at least 2 years before I escaped. But it was a very learning experience. I mean, it was filled with passions. It was filled with addictions. It was filled with different directions that you race and explore, and then you reach a dead end. You like turn around and race the other way, and you explore, and then you reach a dead end. And I think those years in New York shaped me probably more than just about any other time except being in Rehoboth.
And what is it about drugs and the food industry? I mean, we've described this, I guess, before in an earlier interview, but what is this connection? Why is it that if you're in the food industry, you're doing this thing that's pretty fast turnaround stuff, and then it's like, the drugs sort of come with it.
Yeah, so I didn't connect this until later. I didn't really figure this out. But I only did drugs for a very short period of time. So in the process of becoming, you know, drug-free over time, I realized what I was searching for with the drugs was a matching of that intensity that you get with food. And especially on the nightly line, as you're working the nightly line and preparing, there's this rush of adrenaline that just absorbs your whole entire soul, your energy. It's just like your heart is thumping, your mind is racing, and you're whirling, you're dancing, you're in the heat and the fire, and it's sensual. And it's exciting, and it's, I mean, I imagine it's like any adrenaline junkie job that you can have, and that's what a nightline kitchen is like in a popular restaurant. And so when you walk out of that, you all of a sudden walk into stillness, and that stillness feels disconnected. So you're trying to recreate that intensity, I think, through drugs. And also there's the whole, you're so excited, you just worked, it's 12 o'clock at night. How do you go to sleep and get back the next morning? So you go from the, you know, taking uppers and then taking downers and then taking uppers and then taking downers. And I think a lot of people get, at first it's like, okay, well, this works, I can do this, I can have some alcohol and then crash and then get up the next morning and take a line of coke and then go back and do it again, or hit a speed and go back and do it again. And you sort of get sucked in slowly as it starts. And then for me, I reached a point where I realized that that was defining my whole life and defining my cooking rather than facilitating, if that makes sense. Like, I had used that initially as a way to get to work in the morning and a way to go to sleep at the night, but all of a sudden it was becoming the driving force. And I never wanted to have a driving force other than my passion for food. And I also realized that if I ever wanted to have children or a family, that drugs and kids don't mix. So, I mean, it's, right. That was a sort of basic learning experience that I had when I reached 20, is like, you have a choice. You can either do drugs or you can be a responsible member of society. There's a choice there. So I stopped. But I understand people in the industry, how they don't want to stop and how it's a very, very addictive lifestyle.
So in contrast, you meet up with a woman after your divorce and you decide that you're going to become vegan, yeah. Which is in constant contrast to what we've just described before. Just tell me a bit about her and how you decided that you were going to become vegan.
Yeah, so it didn't happen right away. I lived with her for 2 years while I was getting a divorce, and, you know, off and on for 2 years. So we just spent a lot of time together, and she was a very peaceful person. She is a very peaceful person. She's actually, her name is Laura Charcutian, and she's now a delegate in Maryland. She has developed a mediation system, which is here in Salisbury University, as well as around Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia. Community mediation program, if you're interested in looking it up. And she was probably the kindest, most giving person I'd ever met at that point in my life. She listened. She understood. She tried to understand even when she couldn't understand. She didn't have an ego involved with her own presence. It was really more about understanding what makes other people tick. And that was the first time I understood that being a chef could be about cooking for people in a way that made them happy rather than a way that fueled my own ego or made me look fantastic. I mean, It was at that moment, I think, with her that I realized that I could be the most amazing chef in the world, but if somebody couldn't eat my food, then what difference did it make? And that's when food became about taking care of people rather than being awesome. You know, it was all of a sudden that switch that flipped, and it's like, wait, what I do is about nurturing. What I do is about love. And if somebody's vegan and they can't eat what I'm making, then I'm not showing them I love them. I'm showing them that I think I know better. And I decided that I would listen to the people that I was cooking for and find out what made them healthy, happy, and what made them tick. And coincidentally, at that same time, my daughter developed a gluten and dairy allergy. So vegan, gluten, dairy, all of a sudden I had to learn to cook in so many ways that were different from the traditional ways that I had been taught or explored. And so I started to get real creative with making comfort food and loving food in ways that made the people that I loved safe to eat it. I didn't become vegan for another 9-10 years after Lorg, after I lived with Lorg. Mm-hmm. But that was when the seed was planted of, you know, it is okay not to eat meat and be a chef. Like, you can do that. I knew I could at that point.
There's a term, by the way, you use, a dirty vegan. What does that mean?
That means that I'm not freakish about it. Like, I don't get upset if there's eggs and things. I don't get upset. Like, when I travel, I eat dairy. It's not a big deal. You know, it's, I'm not going to go to Israel and not eat feta cheese. I'm not going to go to, you know, Sansepolcro and not eat mozzarella. It's just not going to happen. So I'm okay with that. And I know a lot of vegans are not. But for me, that's okay. I'm okay with it. So it's a dirty vegan.
And is there a difference between being a vegetarian and a vegan?
Yeah. So vegetarians eat animal products that don't harm the animal. Okay. So eggs, dairy, honey. Vegans won't eat anything that comes from an animal at all. So anything that is a product of an animal is not consumed. And there are different varying levels of how vegan people are. And that's one of the issues with, you know, when you have somebody come in that is vegan, it's you have to find out how contamination sensitive they are. Same thing with gluten-free. Like, you know, are they okay with it gets really, really defined. There are straight edge vegans that, you know, don't even eat yeast. I mean, there's some really hardcore lines.
And so you describe, talk about what you at least perceive anyway as being the benefits of being a vegan.
Well, I think more than being a vegan, and this is, you know, probably going to be controversial, but I think more than being a vegan, I think the benefits of eating something that is A, grown close to home, so doesn't travel great distances, B, is seasonal, C, is local, and D, is from whole food made from scratch. So in my own restaurant, what I did was I didn't say, you know, like, look, I don't eat meat, so nobody can eat meat. That's not what I'm about. What I'm about is everyone making their own choices. If you choose to eat meat, then choose to eat chicken that's grown in a healthy manner without antibiotics and hormones. Choose to eat beef that is grass-fed and free-ranged. And, you know, if you choose to eat pork, then make sure that that's happy pork. And that's going to be something that vegans will be like, no, never. But that's not me. I'm not the person who judges other people's choices. So that's why I'm not labeling this book as a vegan cookbook, because if you'll notice in the recipes, a lot of the recipes are like, you know, if you do a chicken, do it this way. If you do tofu, do it this way. If you want to make it plant-based, use a cauliflower steak. If you want to do it meat-based or salmon-based, you know, use a wild piece of salmon. So I offer other options that may not be my choices, but maybe somebody else's choices. And that's what I did in the restaurant as well. Every dish had a vegan, a vegetarian, and a meat-based or a pescatarian-based alternatives. So you could choose your own protein. I just created the sauces and the preparation technique.
You, by the way, talk about the idea of sort of a meat substitute. That is that something that, for instance, you might eat a hamburger, but no, it's not made out of meat. It's made out of something else. Mm-hmm. Something that people need, that maybe it's a psychological sense that they've been eating meat all of their life, and then there's something that they just need to see that on the sure. patty on the buns.
Sure. So I call those transition foods, because a lot of times people, when they're transitioning from eating eating a lot of meat, and let's face it, Americans eat a lot of meat. When they're transitioning from that, that's what they're comfortable with. And if you say to somebody all of a sudden, hey, you're going to eat chana masala 3 meals a day, and, you know, we might be making some, like, very strange things with red lentils and quinoa loaves and nut this and blah, 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 they're going to be, like, looking at you like you have 3 heads and are you insane? So what we do is we create foods that are familiar in their comfort zones. You know, so a veggie-based burger or a cauliflower steak that's sauced or something that looks like it's a meat-based dish, but it's not. Now, I have friends who have been vegetarian their whole lives, and they don't need that at all because they don't even remember what meat tastes like. They're like, I don't like the taste. I never like the taste. So just make me whatever you want. It really depends on where you're at in that transition. And one of the things I like to remind people is we live in the United States and everyone could eat less meat here. So even if you don't think you eat a lot of meat, you probably could eat less. So there's always time to switch to that plant-based food, whether it's a meatless Monday or just choosing not to eat meat, you know, during the days. And like they had that plant-based up until 5 diet that came out last year, which, you know, everything that allows people to eat a little less meat and a little bit more healthily, and by healthy I define as whole foods, not processed, that's a good thing.
Well, that brings me back to the standard American diet. I take you take issue with the standard American diet.
Well, the acronym SAD, I think, describes a lot. We eat processed foods here. We have a very, very high consumption of sugar, and I don't have the exact statistics of how much sugar an average American eats, but it's pretty huge. It's gross. So what I try and do is I try and create foods that replace that sugar that most people are used to in processed foods with caramelized onions and caramelized garlic and other ways of sweetening dishes that people can get that comfort from, because your palate has four flavor centers. It's salty, sweet, spicy, and sour. And if you don't have those flavor centers register, you're not satisfied. And comfort food is usually salty or sweet. So what I try and do is replace that sweet in the comfort food with some other sugar substitute that isn't necessarily sugar, which, you know, agave is sugar, honey is sugar, all those things are sugar. So you have to caramelize vegetables, caramelize fruits, you know, really bring natural foods down into their most base elements to make that sort of sugar feeling in your mouth that substitutes then the comfort foods.
And of course, we here on the shore, up and down the peninsula, we have farmers markets. I mean, they're everywhere. Tell me a little bit about the significance of those markets, but what is it like to be part of one of those markets, to shop there? What are the people like? What was that experience like?
Shopping and participating in the market are two entirely different things. I love shopping in the farmer's market. Participating in a farmer's market and being a vendor is really, really hard, which is one of the reasons why I'm so adamant about supporting them, because these farmers work so hard. They get up at, you know, unbelievable hours, way before dawn. They pack their trucks, they've picked their produce, or they've milked their cows. They get to the farmer's market, they have like 3 or 4 hours to sell all their goods. And if they don't sell them, then they go home and they've lost money. So I really believe that supporting farmers markets are one of the most important things we can do to support our community. Personally, for me, being at the farmer's market was absolutely exhausting. And I think it was part of it was the time of my life, because I was working 6 days a week. And the farmer's market was on my day off, and that was just one more thing that I had to do, and it was too much. But that being said, it certainly helped with my restaurant, getting people through the door of the restaurant, and it created community with the farmers that I bought from for the restaurant, so I could go to the farmer's market, pick up my produce, take it back to the restaurant, meet people, send them to the restaurant if they were vegan, gluten-free, or they needed special dietary choices.
So if I go to a farmer's market, obviously it depends on who I am and what my tastes are. What should I be looking for?
Well, you should be talking to the farmer and asking them how they raise their produce, how they raise their chickens, how they raise their cows, you know, what they do. What you'll find with farmer's markets is, first of all, antibiotics, pesticides, and insecticides are very expensive. And most farmers are pretty careful and judicious about how they spray and how they treat their animals, because they don't want to create that extra expense, and they don't want to, you know, tear up their ground or mistreat their farm soil or mistreat their animals. I mean, most farmers are really conscious. But ask questions, talk to them. When I was buying for the restaurant, I would go and visit the farms that I was buying from so that I could see for myself, you know, how they farmed, what they did. And I will tell you, you know, working for Edible DeMarva, writing articles for them, I've also been visiting a lot of farms over this past year. And it's really fun. I mean, going to a farm is like being a kid all over again. When I tell my daughter that we're going to a farm, she gets all excited. She's like, what is it this time? Is it cows? Is it pigs? Is it chickens? Is it, you know, where are we going? And she loves it because it is such a fun place to be a child.
So some other places, Mexico, you talk about also going to Israel. Mm-hmm. What is it like tasting and exploring foods that are overseas as opposed to, say, exploring those same foods here?
Yeah, it is different, because I find that a lot of restaurants that are ethnic have Americanized their palates. I mean, certainly that's true about Chinese restaurants more than almost any other thing. But it is very different to try the foods that are indigenous to a culture in the space of that culture. And that's one of the things I love to do, is actually go into the markets wherever I go, the open air markets, and watch people in the open air markets do their cooking, because that's where you really learn the techniques. It's almost like watching the Food Channel. You can sit there and watch people make tortillas, and then you really know how to make tortillas if you're watching somebody do it for an hour. You're like, okay, I know how to make a tortilla. I'm going to go do that. And you can ask questions, and you can really get in there and see what's going on. There's this wonderful market I love in Tepoztlan that's in the just nestled right in the center of Zocalo. And you can literally walk from one booth to another booth to another booth, and they're making the ancient Mayan foods that were indigenous to that region. And they're so different than what we have learned in this country is Mexican cuisine, because it's not Mexican, it's Indian. And it's just phenomenal. It's so out there. And, you know, like, you can't get that here when you go to I can't think of a Mexican chain right now, but you can't get that here when you go to one of those Mexican chains. You're not going to get something with chaya. You're not going to get something with quinoa. You're not going to get you're not going to get huitlacoche. Do you know how hard it is to find huitlacoche in this country? I can't get it to save my life. And I know a ton of corn farmers. They're like, yeah, no, we spray for that stuff. I don't want that stuff on my corn. And it's the greatest delicacy you've ever had is huitlacoche. So,
in fact, you call Mexico your home.
Yeah.
Why do you say that? And I think you talk a lot about the women that you see there, that they
sure
compassionate, but also they could be stern.
It's my spiritual home, I think. You know, when I'm there, I am so happy. You know, there's nothing that makes me sad in Mexico. I always feel incredibly safe. I always feel loved. I always feel comforted. And whenever I need to deal with something that's sort of thorny, whenever I want to write, I go there for weeks at a time and just, you know, stay in a little tiny place and hole up and, you know, walk the streets and visit the markets. And it is the women. I speak fluent Spanish, so that makes me very, very happy when I'm home. And it doesn't matter where in Mexico I am, I feel home. It's a happy place. It's my happy place.
So you, as a chef, I'll sort of briefly quote something that you said, because it comes back to something that I said in the introduction. You said, I never planned to be a chef, never. Never fantasized about it as a dream job, never considered it as a fallback. Restaurant work was blue collar and low class, so my career is a result of waiting to be something else.
Yeah. Wow. Can't believe I wrote that. Sometimes I forget the things I write. That's what it was to be a chef at the time that I grew up. And remember, this was before the Food Channel. This was before the Food Network. This was before the glamour of Emeril Lagasse and Paul Prudhomme. And it was, you know, basically you're talking Julia Child and Pierre Franey. And those were the, you know, the sort of food icons that we had. And they were not glamour queens, let's face it. My family, and who knows if it's just or unjust, but they treated the food industry as very blue collar. And in order to have an acceptable job, you needed to do something that required an advanced degree. You needed to marry well. You needed to live in a big house. It was very materialistic, to use a nice word. And the food industry does not give you that kind of security for the most part. Now, you can be successful in the food industry, certainly, but there's so many other jobs you can do and be a lot more successful. And success in my family was just defined as money. So, you know, being a chef was not something you did that you did for glamour. If you wanted glamour, go be an actress in Hollywood. You know, being a chef is not glamorous. Plus, it's a really dirty job. I mean, I don't know if people actually understand that 99% of what you do is dealing with fire, knives, and lifting stuff. You know, I mean, you're flipping pans. When I stopped cooking full time, I had to go actually start lifting weights to keep up my arm strength, because I lifted so much on a daily basis. I literally did not have to lift, and now I have to lift every day in order to keep up my back strength and arm strength.
Now, you had a restaurant, Hobos, and you decided that you were going to get out of it. So what has life been like outside of that? Certainly crazy quality to the food industry. Certainly running a restaurant has got to be similar to maybe something as long ago as the 80s. What's your life been like now? What is it pursued? And how does that contrast with maybe running the restaurant?
Well, I decided to close the restaurant because I realized that it had consumed me. And my children were still young. My eldest daughter was 2 years away from college. And the other one was just entering middle school. And I realized that I really had not been present for most of their childhood, other than one day a week, 2 days a week. And I get that that's fairly typical for a family. You're home on the weekends. But I wasn't even home at nights because I would not finish cooking till 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. And it's hard to be a parent. And that was one of the big reasons that I decided to close. The other big reason was I realized that I was beginning to resent it. I was beginning to resent the demands of my time and feel that the restaurant was consuming everything that I was. I couldn't finish my book. I couldn't write. I couldn't travel. I couldn't do all the things that really feed my soul and make me who I am. So since closing, I have the first couple months I spent very, very quiet. And I just tried to figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up. And if that wasn't a chef, what was that going to be? Because I'd been a chef for so long. And I decided I wanted to write about food and to write. And so basically, over the last 2 years, I've learned how to write. Like, I feel when I first started, I was not a very good writer. But in the process of doing my blog every week and really writing for magazines, and I've written for several magazines and you know, really working on my craft, I feel that I've become much better. And I feel that I can give a lot in the way of perspective about food at this age. And even more than I can give perspective on being in the restaurant industry, because there's so many restaurants. What's one more? But how many people are actually talking about our relationship with food? That's not a common conversation. And most of the conversations that are had about our relationship with food are not from the perspective that food is love and food is comfort and food is nurturing. They're really more about you should be and do this and do that and diet and lose weight. And they're not embracing. They're really pretty narrowly defining, if that makes sense.
Well, you've been speaking with Gretchen Hansen. She has a new book out, When It's Done, The Making of a Chef. Might also tell people that there are a bunch of recipes in there, which we didn't talk about.
There are hundreds of recipes.
But you can check those out as well, and we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. It's about life, death, relationships, addiction, and even sexual abuse. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Nancy Mitchell has compiled a new collection of poems and prose that span that range and much more. The work is entitled The Out of Body Shop, and in addition to writing poetry, she's also a painter. Her father was an oil business executive who was passionate about painting, but she says it was not until her late 30s that she fell in love with poetry, and we have her here in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, and thank you for taking time out of this maniacal schedule to chat with us. We'll make a little space in all this crazy.
So you, as a matter of fact, you open your collection actually with a quote from Robert Desnos from The Awakenings. It says, the key no longer turns in the lock of the mysterious door of bodies. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, and why did you open your book with that way?
Well, I was thinking of the title, The Out of Body Shop, which is a collection. The book itself is the out-of-body shop, and it's the metaphor for the place people find themselves when they've had disorienting experiences where they have disassociation from the body. And, you know, trying to return to that, the keys no longer fit. There's no way to get back in. Like in the out-of-body shop, you actually are there while you try to retrieve the past. And by retrieving specific pieces of the past, you're able to retrofit and then sort of return, which is it's just this idea of we're all in there. Everyone who's had a disassociative experience, whether through, because trauma is relative, really, from the dreamers to people who've been molested, abused, or abandoned, that moment when you're no longer grounded in your body and trying to find a way back. And I did a lot of research on this. Therapeutically, it's trying to recover the pieces of the past that were blown up before you had that experience. And I think one of the ways that, and I don't want this to be confused with catharsis because it really isn't. It's a way of, it's like if you have a memory and it's a memory that sort of haunts you. Well, it has something to tell you. So to go back into it and try to find the images that keep coming back is a way to bring that back to the self. It's transformation in a Jungian sense. You take something that happens, you transform it into something else in terms, say, a painting, a poem, an essay. It's no longer in the body. It's been transformed into something else. And it has a possibility of connecting with other people who have had that experience. And one thing that I find really fascinating is that looking at a painting, reading a poem, you can actually experience the process and the epiphany that the creator had. So it's like the hero's journey in terms of Joseph Campbell talking about the hero stepping away from the tribe. The first step is to step away from the tribe and answer the call. And as you go through the hero's journey, which is really an odyssey to the self, what you bring back is called a boon, and it's a responsibility of, quote unquote, the hero who undertook this journey to share it with the community. And by sharing it with the community, that community evolves a notch, because Jung believed, and I do believe too, that the psyche is always trying to evolve to wholeness. It's trying to recover itself. And I think probably we can all agree that these are very fragmented times. So I think in many ways, the art, the music, whatever articulation of that is what's kind of holding us together and maybe will help us evolve finally out of whatever the cycle is, you know.
As a matter of fact, we've noted that you are a painter as well as a writer. And one of the things I ran across, because you were doing some interviews, it's you said that when it comes to poems, they're triggered by an external source. And then you work backwards to identify the corresponding feeling. With painting, you say you have a vague feeling and you wind up with an image. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the contrast in that creative process.
Well, I think for me, everything, it starts with, I'm an imagist and a lyricist first and foremost. And, I think that I'm more facile with that than probably narrative, in the sense that they always come more easily to me and they come quickly. And they're the leaps between the narrative poems. And with trying to find in a painting, it's a feeling that can be best expressed by color and shape, if that makes any sense. One of the first paintings I did was, when I started painting, I painted a lot. And one of the paintings is called The Red Horse. And I did it in one or maybe two strokes. And I think it's on the, might even be on that interview with Nin Andrews or Best American Poetry blog. And it was that sense of just moving with one stroke and then having this horse, which then I went to, doing some research on horse and red horse. And it's actually, a horse is a bridge between worlds. And I think I was trying to toggle, I guess, between two worlds. I think we always are trying to kind of like a balance board. We're trying to find our way in between what is happening externally, what's happening internally. And it's a challenge. And I think sometimes the only way to do that is to either, it's through the body. Galway Canal said the body makes love possible. And I think that when you said maybe we'll come to our senses when we were talking earlier, I think coming to our senses, coming back to the body, being outside, we live in this little, we're in the digital world so much that we forget that we perceive the world via our senses. So when I'm really, disoriented with everything that's going on now, it really helps me to get out and take a walk or go to the ocean and just try to center in that space that doesn't have anything to do with us in a way. And it keeps going and it's always there and it's not going to stop. That tide is still going to be coming in and going out. And it just takes me to another space. So what about roundabout answer there?
That's okay. Well, let me just ask. One of the reviewers, I think, talked about your work as being the danger of the past is illusory. Do you think that's true of the work that you're talking about? And one of the things that, by the way, that remarks me sort of let's sort of fit some of this in, is I think it was a ghost smoke, you write. And you write, the smell was of my mother, smoke from her mornings alone, smoking as she waited for the kettle to boil, smoking as she washed her face, smoking her only do as I damn well please.
Yeah.
Which is a memory, obviously, evoked by that smell. What about mm-hmm. that the treatment of the past? And is the danger of it simply illusory?
I think it is after it's been transformed. You know, I think the transformation of that information renders it illusory. But it's potent for us because, for example, in ghost smoke, that really happened to me. I did smell smoke, and I didn't know what in the world it was. And I did, you know, started Googling and people, you know, spirits returning as spells. And I did run across a BBC special. It wasn't on TV. Of course, mm-hmm. I took some liberties with the poem. But after I, you know, I thought, well, maybe that's Mom. And then, you know, it was like, gosh, Mom. My sister had so much, she had a better visitation, of course, you know, thanks, smoke.
The smoke, right.
But after I read it several times, people would come up and say, thank you so much for doing that. One guy told me he was in Home Depot. He caught the smell of his mother's perfume, leaned back to try to locate it, and this huge flat of shingles fell off, you know, one of those tiers, and mm-hmm. just grazed his body. And someone told me another story like that. So I thought it was interesting that, and they were so eager to tell me this and to say, yes, finally, I didn't make that up. I tried to tell other people and they looked at me like, yeah, right. And now, you know, so I think that's one of the values of poetry and art is that, you know, it's can be an affirmation for people who have experienced the same thing. And you never know if it's going to be, you know, it's like, gosh, you know.
So. You mentioned that you write about drug addiction and death, and you have the Black Brinton, I guess it's called, and in which I think the final lines are something about the by the time I'm good and gone, the rough rogue current will sweep me away, the only vow much less kept, mm-hmm. in which the individual tries to overcome this addiction, mm-hmm. but ultimately succumbs.
Well, I think what's interesting about that poem is I was working in the community with, I did workshops called We're Writing for Wellness. And so many people came with their grief. They were just encumbered with this grief because they'd lost family to the opioid crisis. And, you know, I heard their stories and heard their stories. And this is really, you know, it's kind of a, you know, I guess amalgamation of the stories that I heard. And I thought, you know, it's not the stereotypical, you know, a scenario where someone starts partying, they start using heroin, and yay, great. This kid had a disorder, the same disorder that the man who took a hammer to the pieta has, where beauty and happiness trigger something in them, and they can't assimilate it, and they go into rages. And they stopped when he was prescribed an opioid for an abscessed tooth. So when I heard all these different stories, I really literally saw a painting and was triggered by that and started writing this poem. And I thought, you know, the redemption is that he had promised himself if he ever wanted to hurt his son, if he felt that ratchet up, and what triggered it was seeing his wife nursing the baby with this shaft of light coming down, which probably made her look like, you know, the Madonna and child haloed by that light. And he felt it. And he said, I will take myself out before I'll hurt my child. And then there's something about, I found it, I remember one of my brothers, when he read it, said, oh gosh, it was sort of like, why we can't have nice things in our family, you know, you go and write poems like this. But at the same time, I thought there was something sort of noble about it in a way. You know, it was like, it wasn't that he couldn't get over the addiction. It was that he knew that the only way he could ever continue was to use again, you know, to mask that. And then it would start the whole cycle again. So he made this vow. And so there is some honor in honoring the vow, if you know what I mean. You know, it touched me I don't know this person, you know, except he spoke through me in terms of a persona.
You also, by the way, touched on, we talk a lot, by the way, about the about social media and this disconnection we often mm-hmm. have, and obviously it's permeated our politics as well. And I love the lines about it, as friends here, in which you say that we like each other, we have emojis, all is now floating text next to a thumbnail, and I can relate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do you make of that disconnection?
I think it's, you know, we're just text all of a sudden, and we're just these pictures and this curated image of ourselves. We're a brand. I mean, never has this ever happened, I don't think, that you're using social media to build this image of yourself as a poet, as a writer. It's very bizarre. I was thinking about my mother who, you know, she was, back in her day, a compliment. I mean, you would never toot your own horn. And if you got a compliment, you would always demur, you know. And I always think, what would she think of this? What would she think of me? Because I've posted things before. But there seems to be this huge kind of gold rush or land rush for this acreage. And, you know, I can't keep up with it. I think it's daunting. I think I'm not good at it. You know, I can't keep up with it. I'm overwhelmed is all I have to say about it. It's overwhelming to me. And it's like it all gets mushed together. And it's like from one day to the next. I mean, we had the tragedy last week, and then there's something else, and everything gets folded under. You know, we lost two big poets in our community, and it's like it just gets folded over. We never have a chance to process. We never have a chance to break it down. We never have a chance to actually feel. I think it makes people numb, you know, and the smallest thing is like I don't know. It's very, I probably need a social media director. If you know anyone, I would be happy to engage them because I'm not good at it. And
do you think it's having then us an impact on the sort of the body politic in general? That we had obviously a number of weeks back the fight over the nomination of a Supreme Court justice. That seems, it was only not too long ago, and now it's disappeared into something else. And it seems like hours, days, and something else dominates our attention span.
It's terrifying. It really is. I mean, that was one of the few times that I thought that people were connecting on social media during the trial. A lot of people were texting back and forth and posting back and forth about it. And I think it triggered. Yes, sorry.
Yeah, that's all right.
I'm sorry. Anyway, someone was on trial.
True.
You know, but I think that it was, it triggered so much for so many people because finally it was like, you can finally say this happened. And I think more people, in fact, there's a poem in there about a young girl who, she was molested by a bus driver. And I think there's actually, that person was me. And I think I would have never told my parents, and I would have never thought to tell my parents. This was someone that, he was a bus driver. He was charged with our safety. He looked like a grandfather. And it was so disorienting. I wasn't even sure that it happened. And then when I would see him later, he would never look at me. And it reminded me of that incredible movie, Iron and the Maiden, with Ben Kingsley and Sigourney Weaver. If you've ever seen it, I don't know if you have, but it's phenomenal because she was a nurse in during concentration camps. She was mm-hmm. in a concentration camp as a nurse, and this doctor abused so many of them that she saw him later in her house. He was a guest in her house, and he didn't recognize her. And the rage that she felt, the rage, and I just thought we were tapping into some rage during that time, and I thought it was healthy and amazing, but it was also absolutely sublimated again. You know, I don't know what happens, you know, there are a lot of energies that are being tapped into now that are very volatile. And I don't know, but like you're saying, how do we process it? I think that it's interesting that I'm hoping that we can all take it in, you know, as a country, what has happened lately, and give it some time, you know, say, okay, let's stop, just maybe for 2 days, let's stop campaigning, let's stop this, let's stop that, let's stop posting about her, let's just stop, just for a little bit, let the dust settle, you know, honor the dead. Yeah. But it goes on. It's a machine.
That's true. It's like, you know, it's tomorrow's. It's a machine. You also, by the way, it's interesting. It's, I guess it was really sort of a piece of prose, the piece that you have at work. And it's this class contrast. And I think one of my favorite lines is that Miss Uppity of going to college with a head full of nothing, which is obviously the view of the workers that she's now engaged with. And I must say, I mean, when I went to college, yes, I did some factory work. And when I'm glad actually I did, because it made me appreciate the people who do that work, you know. Tell me about that. And I mean, and that was one of the most striking kind of like character portraits I think I found in the book.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Maybe I'll read that one. That one's kind of fun. Well, it's the speaker, actually, this, you know, some of these are autobiographical. Many of them aren't, you know, they're persona poems. The speaker actually, you know, got a job at this, you know, here she is, a job before I go to college, you know, and she got it because of the inside influence and thought it would be, and I'm not sure if the women in the factory also weren't just messing with her head, you know, messing with my, I used to come back out of there thinking, oh my gosh. And also, my family history is that my ancestors, I guess they're ancestors now, did have a working plantation that ended up being a farm. And, you know, there's all this connection between the speaker and that past and the African-American community that is really interesting to me, because there was always what's happening on the surface and what is really happening. And the place that you could always go to find out what was really happening would be the kitchen, you know, and you'd hear of something and, you know, how the PR and then what was really happening. So it was interesting to me, those two cultures. And that was always more interesting to me in a way. And interestingly enough, which a lot of my ancestors might roll over in their graves, my grandchildren are biracial. Mm-hmm. And I have 5 grandchildren and they're Korean American, African American. So it's interesting.
I mean, you do capture this sort of knowledgeable skepticism about certainly about the young person who's working at the factory, that I can imagine many people do. I mean, and even to sort of cross the racial divide, I'm sure that there are folks who are white who might have even voted for Trump who look at other people in the same fashion, thinking that they know something about them. That they can see, you know, that they're making this judgment about them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it went both ways. But, you know, I think the factory workers, probably word got around that she got the job because of inside influence. And also that, you know, you don't know the first thing about what really is important. You know, you're going off to college with a head full of nothing. You know, you don't even know how to keep your boyfriend straight, which is horrifying.
In graphic terms, yes.
They are. I know.
Plain spoken. Maybe not graphic, plain spoken.
Plain spoken. And I think that has had mixed reactions when I read it. Maybe I won't read that one.
So how much of this is your personal experience and how much do you derive from others?
Well, it depends on, you know, it's a synthesis, like just with in Black Bitter and hearing those stories. And also my oldest son has been in recovery for going 15, 16 years. But yeah, and also just the deep, deep sadness and this feeling that I was absolutely not qualified to be helping these people, you know, in a writing group. But it did help them, and it helped them to find images for their grief, which was very powerful and very primal, and they weren't cliched at all. And so I think for me, my personal response to this was to write a poem. Everything happens to you, you know, whether it happened to you or you heard it, you become the translator of that experience and try to articulate it. And I think it requires a certain degree of empathy to find that persona in yourself. But some of them might say, you know, probably the speakers in there, the I voice, doesn't mean that I is me necessarily, but it does give it more immediacy than if I wrote it in the second person, you know. I think it does. I think you're pulled into it more.
You also write about infidelity.
Yes.
And actually reminded me of a song that somebody wrote about that, in which actually the woman is sneaking home. It's the metaphor is a baseball field. But at the very end of the poem, right, he says that if he'd get back home before his wife, the snow really started coming down. Mm-hmm. This, he's involved with this, but his mind is halfway out the door.
Right. Right. And he's thinking, you know, before everything starts coming down. So it's, you know, the snow coming down and the potential grief coming down if he doesn't get back home in time. So, you know, it's always that never being there, another out-of-the-body experience, not being where one is. You know, always the mind elsewhere. And I think our minds are elsewhere more than and more often. And the not, I think I do, me personally. But
and that's where you live to do poetry, right?
I think so. Fortunately, I live on Shoemaker Pond, and I get to look out the water a lot, which is it's good for me to do that. It's a calming kind of thing. And you know, I'm married to John Ebert, who works for Channel 47. He's a wonderful actor and filmmaker, and he is a wonderful person to be married to. He puts up with me, puts up with a lot. He's so much more organized. He's just, you know, he has a different brain, a better brain than mine, I think, in terms of
well, I don't know, it's just different.
And getting through the world.
Okay.
So
I don't want to leave without. Actually, I have to read. While in the Body, I think is
I
was looking at.
You like that? Okay.
Yeah, it's a nice short and sweet, but maybe a little more uplifting.
Oh, yeah. We need a little more uplifting.
Yeah, a little uplift.
Yes. Well, I always, you know, this is probably where I'm off the mark, but I think that there's something kind of uplifting in all of them. In a sense that something's recognized. There's something in them that honors the person.
Yeah.
You know, and honors that moment and doesn't kind of make a judgment about it, but let's see, where are we with, 35, okay. While in the body, I was in the body, but not of the body. I neither grew nor aged an alabaster egg. Under a furled rib cage, like a lover, I spooned the heart and bided my time, counting beats to the lullaby. Arterial freeway, traffic of blood.
There's a certain expectancy of optimism, I think, in that.
Mm-hmm.
That life, because while that's still in the womb, that sort of thing, but there's some expectation too of the outside world, far better place, perhaps, than it really is, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's that sense that, you know, the soul is in the soul, the embryo, the new life is biding time to the lullaby, biding their time. And then, you know, their time in the world will be what it will be in whatever. I think that we always have a choice in a way. We have to not give up. We always have to be looking for, in every situation, what might be the noble and the just, you know, even if it looks like it to the contrary by typical standards. With Black Bitter, and that man decided, I will honor this one vow I've ever made, much less ever kept. And there was something in it that I don't know why it seemed to have its own nobility, because everything else was seemed rather doomed in terms of how he would continue.
In terms of poems, and I think you mentioned it, that it's not enough, that the poetry is something that you find meaning in when you revisit it. I think it's sort of paraphrasing what you meant. And I've always been struck by the fact that if you really want to understand a poem, you memorize it.
I agree. Absolutely. You have to get it in your body, in your rhythm, over and over and over again. And that poem will always be a source for you and reveal itself over and over again. So, you know, and I think it's great that people write lots and lots of books and lots of poems. But, you know, really and truly, gosh, I wonder how many of Keats' poems, you know, masterpieces. It's that in a poet's career, they'll probably have maybe 10 or 15, like, stellar poems that will stay, you know, the endurance of that. I'm not sure if quantity is quality.
And you, by the way, you also, one other observation before we go, you talk about procrastination as it's a good thing. That is to say that it allows you to simmer, I guess, allow ideas to simmer. And I mean, tell me a little bit about that. Is there hope for me yet?
Well,
I
just hope it's not a rationalization. But actually, I think that it's, you know, the time that things are kind of, it's like a, you know, kind of alchemy. It's a sealed vessel that you're thinking about things. And then, you know, the processing is going on during procrastination. And there's a lot of studies to support that, quote unquote, you know,
right, whatever
science. But yeah, I think procrastination is musing. You know, not jumping to conclusions, not jumping on the first thing, and just allowing it to kind of rise up to the surface, like those wonderful, remember Magic 8-Balls. You know, right. See what comes up and let it come up, and, you know, don't force it. There's a lot of work out there that people go back and say, "Oh gosh, I wish I hadn't posted that," or "I wish I hadn't published that." I look back and say, "Oh gosh, I could have waited a little bit longer." I'm kind of, you know, for that, processing it. And again, I hope it's not a rationalization, but whatever it is,
it's good enough for me.
Yes.
We're speaking with Nancy Mitchell. She is a poet. Her latest work compilation, The Out of Body Shop, which is a collection of poetry and some prose as well. She's also a painter. So I appreciate you taking the time to stop by and chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was wonderful to be here. And, you know, good luck with your rest of your day. I guess we're out into the breach now, both of us. But this was lovely to be here in this nice spot talking about these things. Thank you.
Thank you. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit pac14.org.